From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the First Lady on Whitewater and Travelgate. A longtime child advocate, Hillary Rodham Clinton has written a new book about child welfare called It Takes a Village. Also today, the allure of high-risk adventure for a certain kind of young man. We talk with journalist John Krakauer. His new book reports on a young man who turned his back on his family, gave away everything he owned, and hiked into the Alaskan wilderness, where he was found dead 4 months later. Krakauer says he was haunted by parallels to his own story. And Ken Tucker reviews Kirk Franklin and the Family. Billboard magazine described them as 1995's biggest story in gospel music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Pentagon says retired U.S. soldiers will begin training Bosnian Muslim troops within the next 2 months to make sure they can defend themselves after the NATO peacekeeping operation ends. The training will focus on tactics and weaponry skills. The retired soldiers work for a Virginia firm called Military Professional Resources. They'll be hired as independent contractors by the Bosnian government, with the bulk of the cost to be borne by Islamic nations. The U.S. military will not be involved. Filipino human rights activists in Hong Kong have protested the opening there of secret negotiations about how to distribute some $475 million the late Philippines dictator Ferdinand Marcos left in Swiss bank accounts. Negotiators include the Swiss bank officials, the lawyers for Marcos's widow Imelda, the Philippine government, and the victims of human rights abuses. NPR's Mary Kay Magstadt reports from Hong Kong.
This week's talks are designed to cut through its controversy about who has legal rights to Marcos's millions. Filipino human rights activists protested outside the hotel where the talks were being held. They said they believe the mediation conference is, to quote their statement, nothing but a meeting of unprincipled, money-motivated plotters whose sole purpose is to divide the ill-gotten wealth amongst themselves. Ironically, one claimant in negotiations this week is speaking on behalf of 10,000 Filipinos who won a class action suit in a Honolulu district court 3 years ago. The court had found Marcos guilty of violating their human rights and had ordered his estate to pay out $1.9 billion, which it has yet to do. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Hong Kong.
CIA Director John Deutsch flew into Cali, Colombia today to observe the massive manhunt for the drug lord who escaped in broad daylight from a maximum security prison there last week. Roadblocks have been set up throughout the city, and authorities have been searching offices and apartment buildings. Deutsch will also hold talks with Colombian President Ernesto Samper in Bogota. Maybelline has received a second takeover bid. A German cosmetics company has offered to top the $508 million offer by L'Oreal. Bloomberg's Catherine Oliver reports.
Someone else is making eyes at Maybelline. A German perfume and cosmetics maker is talking about topping a $660 million takeover offer by L'Oreal. Benckiser is not saying how much more it's willing to pay. It makes and markets household goods and cosmetics, including Coty perfumes and Calgon liquid bath soap. Analysts say that the German company's bid would not run into antitrust problems because its businesses don't overlap Maybelline's. Both Maybelline and L'Oreal have similar cosmetics product lines. I'm Catherine Oliver.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 12.25 points at 5,048 in moderate trading. In the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ Composite is down 15. This is NPR News. President Clinton says Martin Luther King Jr. redeemed the moral purpose of the U.S. Mr. Clinton gave the keynote address at a memorial service at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta today. The president said King reminded us that everyone is entitled to the full benefits of American citizenship. Vice President Al Gore has assured Israel that the U.S. strongly backs its efforts to reach a peace agreement with Syria. Gore's visit to Israel is intended to show that the Clinton administration is determined to achieve a comprehensive Middle East peace this year. Tomorrow, Gore will meet with PLO leader Yasser Arafat in the West Bank town of Jericho, which is now under Palestinian control. For the first time, an Israeli high official has honored members of the World War II German resistance. NPR's Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
During a four-day state visit, Israeli President Eitzer Weizmann visited the memorial of Plötzensee in Berlin. The Nazis executed more than 2,000 regime opponents at the site. After laying a wreath, President Weizmann spoke with Germans who fought against the Nazis. Yesterday, Weizmann and German President Roman Herzog visited the former Nazi concentration camp at Sachsenhausen in eastern Germany. The Israeli president opened an exhibition there on Jewish prisoners, telling German youth to study what happened and prevent it from reoccurring. Tomorrow, Weizmann will address the German Bundestag. The visit has been marred by the parliament's failure to ratify a treaty giving pensions to German-speaking Jews who survived the Holocaust. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Russian military forces stormed into a small village where Chechen separatists have been holding some 100 hostages for several days now. The troops were supported by artillery and helicopter gunships. It's been about 12 hours since the operation began, and Russia's Interior Ministry says the full-scale military portion of the assault is nearly complete now. Five dozen rebels have reportedly been killed, but there's still no word on the hostages. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hillary Rodham Clinton is beginning a tour to promote her new book, It Takes a Village. Based on her own family experiences and her work as a child advocate, it explains her vision of an enlightened national agenda for families and children. Her tour coincides with new questions about her involvement in Whitewater and the story that's become known as Travelgate. Last week, the White House released billing documents from her days with the Rose Law Firm in Arkansas. Republicans leading the Whitewater investigation say these documents show she played a greater role than she's admitted in representing the Arkansas Savings and Loan, which is at the center of the Whitewater story. Also last week, a memo emerged written by the former White House Director of Administration saying that the controversial firing of the White House travel staff was, quote, in conformity with her wishes. I spoke with Hillary Rodham Clinton about these controversies and other matters. Hillary Rodham Clinton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here with you.
I think both the Whitewater and the Travel Office story are hard to follow if you're not keeping up with them every day. But the larger message that gets across is that there may have been a conflict of interest. You may have allowed others to be misled, or worse, you may have lied or covered up. And that's particularly problematic because you've always spoken about the need for a political agenda based on virtue, morality, the greater good. Do you see any conflict between the way you've handled the investigations and the virtues you've tried to stand for in your public life?
No, but I think just the way you asked the question certainly illustrates the problem. There have been a series of allegations made for the last 4 years. And every time we disprove one and it is shown that what I said 4 years ago, for example, about Whitewater, which started this whole thing when we were asked if we'd lost money, and I said yes, and people disputed it, and now an independent report by an independent law firm confirms that we have, the ground shifts. And so I think that part of what's going on here is a partisan agenda that is focused on undermining the kinds of programs and values that the president and those of us who are near to him support.
Well, what's your perspective on how important, say, the travel office story is?
Well, I think that any story that affects the White House is important. But what I have said is the same thing ever since this occurred, that I expressed concern about reports of financial mismanagement that had apparently begun before the president took office and that have been verified by an independent accounting firm which found financial mismanagement in the White House travel office. And I was not alone in expressing those concerns, and the situation was cleaned up. And I can assure people that today that travel office operates according to appropriate accounting procedures. But my concern is something that has been well known from the beginning. I did not make the decisions. I did not direct that a particular decision be made. So I think that that's where it will stand.
You and your husband are gearing up for his reelection campaign. While you're facing more investigations into Whitewater, the travel office story, the Paula Jones allegations, you know, in a way, you yourself don't need the White House to do the work that you do.
in a way, I would wonder, why would you want to keep going through this? Why would you want to stay in the White House and leave yourself exposed to just more personal investigations about your private lives and your work?
Well, in part, I don't think it's any coincidence that our being in the White House has created this a spate of stories and accusations. There's a connection. This happened to begin when my husband first said he was going to run for president and bring a different kind of approach to American politics, what he called the New Democrat approach, which I believe is what most Americans, if they understand it and follow it, actually do want, as we're seeing now in the budget debate. But certainly his political beliefs are strongly opposed not only by his political opponents, but by very strong interests that have a stake in keeping things the way they want them to be. So part of your question would imply that we should walk away from the strong opinions that the president and the millions of people who support him have about the kind of country we want, because inevitably we're going to face, in my view, accusations designed to try to undermine his credibility and mine so that he cannot carry out his agenda. I think that would be a very sad conclusion to reach, not only for this president, but for anyone who took on strong interests.
Do you accept any responsibility for having mishandled any of the investigations?
Well, I certainly think that it came as such a shock to both of us to have these questions raised. And when we answered and told to the best of our ability what we knew and what we remembered, to have people question us, and then, of course, years later to find out indeed we had told the truth the first time, that I don't think we were as prepared or as understanding of what we were going to go through. And in retrospect, I'm sure we would have made decisions differently about how to handle the matter. But that doesn't relate to the underlying truthfulness that we have demonstrated consistently month in and month out, no matter what somebody says or what new allegation or new charge they come up with. But certainly, if you've never been in a presidential campaign before, and if you've never been in the White House before, nothing can prepare you for how it's not only the extraordinary degree of scrutiny, it's how everything you say, everything you do has meaning imputed to it, whether or not that's what you intended.
My guest is Hillary Rodham Clinton, and I want to get to the book that you've written, which is called It Takes a Village and Other Lessons Children Teach Us. And it's about children, which is one of the issues, one of the most important issues on your agenda as First Lady. You say that you grew up in the kind of family people get nostalgic for when they get nostalgic for the family of the past. You describe it as an almost father knows best kind of family that you grew up in. Would you have ever wanted to go back to that as an adult woman?
No, I would not, Terry. And that's part of the point that I want to make in this book, is that the good old days were never everything people in their nostalgic memory think of them as. And many of the problems that we're dealing with now and many of the changes that have occurred since my growing up in the 1950s have either been inevitable or welcome, as well as bringing new challenges to us. As I was growing up, the message that I received from both my parents was one of encouragement to pursue whatever interests I had and to get the best education I could. That was the case for many of the girls that I went to school with. And I know that part of what we are struggling with now is how to define a new kind of partnership between men and women, husbands and wives, mothers and fathers. And as I write in the book, I think that what is important is that the functions that are necessary for strong family life and raising children be performed without the rigid expectation that men can only do certain things and women are expected only to do other things that really did define much of the culture previously.
When did you realize in your life that you wanted something else from, you know, different from the kind of family you grew up in? Which isn't to say anything about your family, but that you wanted a different kind of life.
I think as a child growing up, one of the great gifts my parents gave me, particularly my mother, was to consider other possibilities for my own life. So I can't put a date or a year on it. But that was not to say that there was any denigration of the roles that my parents played. In fact, to me, and again, as I write in the book, it was not unusual to see my parents in a traditional marriage performing functions that were considered the role of the other sex, so that if they both played sports, I saw nothing unusual about that. If they both cooked, I thought that was something that was ordinary. And part of what they helped me develop was a sense that each individual, and particularly women, should be equipped to make the best choices for her own life. And if that choice is to live a life like my mother lived, as a full-time homemaker and caregiver, and if it's the right choice for a woman, she should not be reluctant to make it, no matter what the other cultural messages are. While at the other hand, if the choice is for women not to marry, not to have children, but to devote themselves to a profession, a job that they care about, that also should be respected. And then, as most of us, we are trying in the middle to have family lives and lives of work outside the home at certain parts of our growing, then that too should be respected. And our society should do what it can to help every parent and every worker be very responsible and successful in fulfilling both of those important roles.
Obviously, you would like to bring the public around to your way of thinking. And, you know, the popular perception is that you've tried to change your image a few times in order to, be less threatening to people who are threatened by an independent woman or, you know, a working woman or a woman who's perceived as a feminist. Do you feel like you've tried to change your image to help explain your stand on the issues to the American public? And if so, is it effective to change your image? Does it work?
Well, I don't think I have. I think that I have pretty much been the same person, with the exception of my changing hairdos, which I had done on a regular basis before I ever arrived in the White House. So I think a lot of that is projection by other people who are looking to use me to explain some other point they're trying to make. And I understand that that goes with the territory. But I have been consistent in my own involvement with and concern on behalf of children's and women's issues my entire adult life. So I think a lot of this has to do with just sorting out the roles and opportunities that women have today.
You know, a lot of men growing up, a lot of boys growing up are supposed to aspire to be president. Mothers are supposed to look at their boys and say, someday he'll be president, I know it. Did you ever aspire to be first lady? Did you ever?
It never crossed my mind. I cannot imagine. You know, once jokingly in high school, I thought of the least likely thing that I would ever end up doing. And I said, oh, I'm going to grow up and be a senator's wife and live in Washington. And I did it totally tongue-in-cheek because I thought it was such a ridiculous thing to even think about. Well, here I am, and I'm living in the White House.
My guest is Hillary Rodham Clinton. She's written a new book about children and family policy called It Takes a Village. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is the First Lady, Hillary Rodham Clinton. You've been active in children's issues since the beginning of your career. You were working with the Children's Defense Fund in the 1970s. How did that become an important issue for you?
You know, I think it started really when I was a teenager, and I began to be exposed to kids who were from the inner city of Chicago or were, you know, the children of migrant farm workers who were having very different lives than I was in my, you know, suburb of Chicago. And my interest in child development just kept growing so that when I got to Yale, I was in the law school, but I arranged to take a special additional year at the Yale Child Study Center so that I could immerse myself in what it takes for children to be given the sustenance and love and discipline and support they need to grow up healthy and resilient and strong. And then I took that into the public policy arena when I went first to work after law school for the Children's Defense Fund. I saw firsthand how so many children were being deprived of their chance to develop. And that work just led into a whole range of projects and concerns that I had, which have kind of kept me occupied ever since.
You campaigned for Goldwater, for Barry Goldwater in 1964. Your father was a Republican. Where did you change in your life and go from Republican to Democrat?
Well, you know, the kind of Republican that my father was and that I understood Senator Goldwater to be back when I was a young girl is not really around much longer. You know, my father was a strong believer in individual responsibility, but he also moved us to a suburb where he knowingly would pay higher taxes because he wanted us to be in a town that valued education. He supported common efforts like parks and recreational facilities at the local level, and he supported helping people who needed help and couldn't necessarily do it on their own. Now, certainly I was influenced not only by my family and the town I grew up in, but by the times in the 1960s and early 1970s. So my political opinions evolved, but I don't think if you were to, you know, go down them, they are that much different from much of what I was raised to believe. I don't recognize this current Republican Party as being the party of my father and the way that he viewed politics. I see it as something quite reactionary, not conservative.
You have a new book called It Takes a Village and Other Lessons Children Teach Us. This is a question with two halves to it. First, I'd like to know what you want your book to accomplish, why you wanted to take time out to do a book. And also, it's the book is getting published at an awkward time for you because it's a time when Whitewater and the travel office stories are very much in the news. So the second half of the question has to do with, did you consider canceling your interviews?
No, not at all. You know, I have absolutely no control over what happens in these various investigations. That is in somebody else's bailiwick. No, this book is so much more important to me than all of the rest of this. I think that many of our children are getting short shrift in today's society, starting at home, unfortunately, where parents are pressed by economic worries, where sometimes they're too busy to take care of their children, where they substitute material possessions for the time that kids need, but not just in the home, in our workplaces where we are not very family friendly, in the media, which I think is contributing to the breakup and breakdown of familial values and what children learn about the world outside, to the government, which has done some good things but needs to do things differently.
One more really quick question. The Washington Post, in a headline on the day we're speaking, Friday, January 12th, says, for the First Lady, the overriding issue is credibility regarding Whitewater and the travel office. Do you agree? Do you feel like your credibility is at stake here? Because things that you've said have been contradicted by others. Records you said weren't there have turned up and so on.
I don't think there are contradictions. I know that people are working overtime to create contradictions, but I have done the best I could based on my own memory and my own personal knowledge to answer questions over the last several years. You know, I think I have a pretty good memory, but I am not a total recall whiz. And certainly, I remember things that are important to me far better than I remember things that were not important at the time. So I believe if everybody would just take a deep breath, the fact that we have already proven that all the questions about Whitewater, whether or not we lost money 20 years ago, whether or not we were passive investors, those have all been shown to be absolutely the truth. And then the inquiry moved on to Madison Guarantee, a savings and loan, where it first was alleged that my husband and I had taken money or we had money channeled to us. We denied it, said it wasn't true. Lo and behold, it wasn't true, and that also has been proven. It's very difficult when you're being asked questions constantly based on events that occurred 10 and 20 years ago to have either total recall or, frankly, to remember some of it at all. And so every time we can, we come up with any piece of information that we can to help answer these questions. Nobody wants this over with more than I do. Yet you can see that on these records that recently turned up, a month ago we were accused of destroying them. They show up. I happen to be delighted they showed up since, in fact, they do validate what I have been saying. And now we're accused of something else. It's a constant moving target. Nobody should be surprised if there are inconsistencies in memory among people who are doing the best they can to remember things they may have experienced differently, may have thought about differently even at the time. But the fundamental truth about whether or not we have been credible, I don't believe anybody can point to anything of significance and say it has not been the way we said it was. And that's how this will finally peter out in the end, but we'll all have to live through it.
Hillary Rodham Clinton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
The First Lady has written a new book called It Takes a Village and Other Lessons Children Teach Us. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the story of a young man who lived out the fantasy of giving away his possessions and walking into the Alaskan wilderness. But this man never made it out alive. Journalist John Krakauer reports on the story and the disturbing parallels to Krakauer's own youthful adventures. Also, Ken Tucker reviews a CD by the gospel group Kirk Franklin and the Family. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Chris McCandless lived out a fantasy similar to one shared by many young people. At the age of 24, after graduating from Emory University, where he edited the student paper, he cut his ties with his family, gave away all his possessions, burned the cash in his wallet, changed his name to Alexander Supertramp, and hiked into the Alaskan wilderness. But the story ends different from the fantasy. McCandless died of starvation after eating a poisonous plant. When journalist John Krakauer told the story in Outside Magazine, it drew more mail than any previous article. Krakauer has expanded the article into a book called Into the Wild. Krakauer says he was haunted by the parallels to his own reckless adventures when he was in his 20s. 4 months after McCandless hiked into the wilderness, his decomposing body was found by moose hunters in an abandoned bus which McCandless was using for refuge in the Alaskan bush. McCandless had left an SOS note on the bus.
His writing was, you know, perfect. He wrote in these perfect block letters, and it was written on the back of a page torn from Taras Bulba by Nikolai Gogol. And the note reads, SOS, I need your help. I am injured, near death, and too weak to hike out of here. I am all alone. This is no joke. In the name of God, please remain to save me. I am out collecting berries close by and shall return this evening. Thank you, Chris McCandless. August. And that was one of the final things he ever wrote, perhaps the final thing.
But of course, when he was found, when that note was discovered, he wasn't out hunting for berries. He was dead, and his decomposed body was in the bus.
Right. I think what happened was he posted that note, went out foraging for berries, came back, and just left the note up. By that point, the poison that killed him, this plant that killed him, it poisons you very insidiously. It doesn't poison you outright. It prevents your body from essentially metabolizing whatever food you do eat. So there was some food he was getting, but it didn't really matter. Whatever he ate wasn't going to be digested. It wasn't going to do him any good. So he got weaker and weaker, and at some point, I mean, he couldn't even get out of bed, so he just left that note up, I think. He, you know, the note was on the tape to the door, and he had these red knitted, like, leg warmers, kind of like big knee socks that he tied to the end of an alder stick as sort of a signal flag and propped that up out of the bus. So he was trying to attract attention. You know, maybe when he slipped into unconsciousness, he was hoping someone would see the note, and come rushing in and take it seriously. But the hunters arrived, I think, something like 19 days after he died.
What were his biggest mistakes in the bush?
Well, he was good at everything he ever did, so he was supremely overconfident. That was probably his greatest mistake. You know, a lot of people have criticized McCandless, especially Alaskans. They say he didn't respect the land enough. He was too cocky. You know, he didn't give it the respect it deserves. He didn't take enough gear, enough equipment, enough food. You know, all he had was a 10-pound bag of rice and a .22 rifle and not much more. So in one sense, that was a mistake. But I don't see it quite the same way, because he was looking for a challenge. In his mind, any challenge in which the outcome is assured isn't a challenge at all. It's, you know, why do it if you know you're going to succeed? So he, you know, he didn't have a map. It wasn't because he was too stupid. You know, he didn't think to bring a map. He intentionally left the map behind because, you know, he was looking for a blank spot on the map, and in this day and age, there are none. So he created one by leaving the map behind. Similarly, he didn't have a large caliber rifle. He didn't have much of all. It was just to sort of make the game more fair, you know, give the wilderness a fair shot. That's sort of how what he was up to. It wasn't so much that he was just stupid. He was overconfident. And you have to remember, he almost succeeded. If it hadn't been for this one mistake, eating a plant that he thought was edible and it turned out to be poisonous, it was the plant that he ate was not known to be poisonous before. It had never been documented to be poisonous. That's what did him in, and a lot of people might have made that same mistake had they been in that situation.
You say he didn't really keep much of a diary, that it was just little notes, like one-word, two-word notes.
Mm-hmm.
But he did write a note when he got to the bus that his body was eventually discovered in. And you describe it as a declaration of independence. And reading that note, I started to think, here's somebody who really wanted to be the hero of a great book. I mean, who wanted to have his life described in between the covers of a book. Let me read that note. And this is Chris McCandless's description of himself at that point. He says, 2 years he walks the earth, no phone, no pool, no pets, no cigarettes, ultimate freedom, an extremist, an aesthetic voyager whose home is the road. Escape from Atlanta, thou shalt not return, cause the West is the best. And now, after two rambling years, comes the final and greatest adventure, the climactic battle to kill the false being within and victoriously conclude the spiritual pilgrimage. 10 days and nights of freight trains and hitchhiking bring him to the great white north. No longer to be poisoned by civilization, he flees and walks alone upon the land to become lost in the wild. Signed, Alexander Supertramp, May 1992. It almost reads like if you wanted to be the hero of Kung Fu or something, you know, and the prologue to the TV series was about you wandering the earth and all of that. Do you know what I'm saying? It's self-mythologizing.
Oh, absolutely. It was very self-mythologizing and self-dramatizing. But, you know, when you're there, I've been in that position, and I sort of have done similarly vain, declarations. So, I mean, you're so... You know, you have to remember, for 2 years, he's been wandering around in the back of his mind. This Alaska quest is always there. He hitches to Alaska. He hikes in. He founds this really cool old bus that's this sort of manna from heaven. You know, in the middle of the bush is this bus. What the hell is it doing there? But it's there, and it's shelter. And he's just so jazzed, you know. He's like, yeah, it's working out. You know, my adventure's working out. So he just sort of starts with these lines from the, you know, King of the Road, Roger Miller song. And so, yeah, he was, you know, it's silly to look at it in a certain light. But another, you know, the guy was 24, and he was ecstatic. You know, he clearly, you know, referring himself to Alexander Supertramp and these allusions to Jack London, you know, you want to say, come on. But on the other hand, he was young, and he was full of himself. And I can forgive that. I was like that. So that doesn't, you know, I can let him slide with that.
You found certain parallels between Chris's life and your own when you were in your 20s. When you were 23, you went to climb Devil's Thumb. What is Devil's Thumb?
It's a mountain most people have never heard of, nor should they have. It's a spectacular thumb of granite that rises out of this vast ice cap in Alaska, very near the coast. You can see it from the water. People on ferry boats and cruise ships going up the Inside Passage can see it. It's very distinctive. It's near the town of Petersburg. And at the time, this was back in 1977, its great north face, which rises more than 6,000 feet from the glacier to space, had never been climbed. Actually, it still hasn't been climbed, that face. So I decided that this was a worthy challenge, and I would go do it, and I would do it alone. It was crazy. I mean, it was way more crazy than McCandless's adventure.
Why was it even crazier?
It seemed more dangerous. The odds of getting killed were greater. There were many hazards. Traveling on glaciers by yourself, you know, glaciers are crisscrossed with crevasses, these cracks as the glacier moves. These big cracks open up, and you can't see them often. They're covered with snow. So as you walk along, it's very common to just drop, you know, 200 feet into the bowels of the glacier. That's why you always rope up with another person so the other person can pull you out. But when you're alone, you don't have that luxury. So I got around that by buying a couple of curtain rods, 10-foot curtain rods, and making this cross and strapping it to my waist, hoping that if I, you know, went through a slot, the curtain rods would catch on the edge and hold me out and keep me out. And they did. In a number of occasions, they saved my bacon. But it was, you know, if they'd been a little bigger, they wouldn't have. It was not a smart thing to do, what I did. But I survived, you know. And it was, to this day, I'm really glad I did it. It's the most powerful experience I've ever had in my life. I mean, it really, at the time, I didn't think it changed me much, but over the years, I've looked back at it, and I sort of marvel that I did it, and I'm proud of myself for doing it and for surviving it. And, you know, what can I say?
What was your motivation for doing it?
Just like Chris, you know, I had this, it's so hard to articulate because people, it doesn't make any sense, but I just had a sense of if I just did a climb that was hard enough, that was good enough, that was challenging enough, and pulled it off, everything else would be okay. You know, how could it not? If you've done something that is the hardest thing you can think of and pull it off, on some level, it seems like you should be rewarded for that. Not monetarily, but just, you know, cosmically, psychically, you should feel good for the rest of your life. And of course, it doesn't work that way. But you don't know that when you're 23. And I think Chris had the same sense. I mean, he went into the bush for his last great adventure to kill the, whatever it was, the evil being within. You know, it was the same sense of, well, this is so hard it's so difficult and challenging that if I pull it off, you know, I'm going to feel so good about myself that everything else will be okay.
What did your parents have to say about your adventure when you started out on it?
Well, I wasn't in much touch with my parents at the time. I mean, I wasn't as estranged from my family as Chris was from his. I mean, I remained in contact with my mom and my father less so. But they didn't really know what I was doing. I mean, I just said I'm going to Alaska to do this climb. And they worried every time I went to Alaska to do some climb. But they had no idea what I was doing. They worried about bears mostly when I went to Alaska, because grizzly bears are kind of scary. But there are no bears on these glaciers, or not once you get a few miles inland. So they, you know, I came back alive and they were happy, but they didn't really appreciate what I was doing. They were so confused and baffled by me. I mean, I went to a good college. They did everything they could to set me up for a good career, and I just sort of turned my back on all that and became a climbing bum and a carpenter and got by on nothing and drove a $100 car. And, you know, I think I was a bit of an embarrassment to them, but I think I just made them sad. They wondered, you know, what had gone wrong? Why couldn't they knock some sense into my head and let me see that, you know, you had to do certain things in society to make it. But
had you written them off?
I don't think I ever consciously wrote them off. I was, you know, I had a sense of that my father and I were so at such odds. You know, we had such different values that I didn't see that we would ever reconcile. But I like my mom. She's a great lady. You know, I liked seeing her when I was home. I am close to my – I have four siblings, and I liked them. So it wasn't quite like that. And I was so, you know, when you're 23 and you're like me or McCandless, you're so wrapped up in your own string. You know, you're narcissistic, you're selfish. You don't think about other people that much. You know, you are what's important. And that's, you know, hopefully you outgrow that. You just know, it never occurs to you that if you die, you're going to make a lot of people very sad. I mean, that's the last thing on your mind. So
you did finally climb the Devil's Thumb, although you took a route that was easier than the route you'd initially set out to do. When you achieved what you'd set out to achieve, you had accomplished something that was for you very important. What did you want from other people? What kind of acknowledgement did you want from them? Did you want them to say, here is a changed man? Here is a man who has been perfected spiritually and physically by the experience that he was just brave enough and daring enough to have?
I guess that's what I wanted, but I never thought it through well enough. I mean, my logic was very elliptical and hard to figure out. I mean, I never thought it through that clearly. If I had, I would have never gone. I mean, it was much more something from the gut. If I do this, everything's going to work out. You know, I got back and some people didn't believe I did it. Some said, sure, you did it. Who cares? And it was sort of a blow. I mean, some people said, hey, that's cool. But it's not like anyone said, yeah, you know, you're transformed, you're a hero or whatever. I mean, you know, people basically could care less. And that was sort of a blow. But when that passed, I realized that for a long time after that, it did satisfy me. And I was proud of myself. If other people weren't, I was proud of myself for sort of sticking it out. And it was a pretty miserable at times. And I could have gone back out and skied back out to the ocean and flagged down a boat. But I stuck it out, did the climb. And over the years, you know, I looked back and I said, yeah, all right. You know, if something's going bad at work, if some editor's on my case and deadlines are getting me down, it's like, you know, hell, I climbed the Devil's Thumb. I can handle this.
My guest is journalist John Krakauer. His new book is called Into the Wild. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist John Krakauer. I don't know if you have children or not, but let's say you had a son who was in his early 20s and said to you, Dad, you know, I'm leaving. In fact, I'm going to the wilderness and I'm going to perfect myself spiritually there and challenge myself physically and see what happens. Bye.
I would Oh, man, I would freak out. I've thought about this a lot because I don't have kids. I've got a whole herd of nieces and a nephew that I love very much, and they're entering adolescence, and I'm terrified, more terrified than their own parents, about what's going to happen to them. And I hope one of them has asked me to teach her to climb, and I've taken her out to a climbing gym once, and I sort of hope she loses interest because I wouldn't want my kid to climb or do anything like that. I'd be terrified. I mean, God, you know, the odds of them getting killed are just too great. I don't know what you do. I think part of the problem is you've got to let your kid do that stuff. The more you try to tell them they can't, the more they want to do it. That's how it was in my case. That's how it was in McCandless's case. I mean, Walt McCandless, he tried everything. Yeah, the father tried everything. He tried all kinds of things to talk Chris out of these crazy stunts. You know, he first tried yelling at him, and that didn't work. So then he realized he'd just play tennis with him, sit him down. Chris, you know, do you think about maybe just pulling back a little, or just a little, you know, or maybe just call us when you get back? And that infuriated Chris, you know, more than ever. He thought, he saw it as, you know, unreasonable meddling, and his father was being a tyrant, and how dare he tell him, you know. And that's the way kids are. It's like, you know, my father indoctrinated me from an early age that I was going to go to medical school and be a doctor, and like he was, and go to Harvard and all this stuff. And, you know, that was the worst thing he could have ever done. I mean, I think something to be said for reverse psychology. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I'll ever have kids. It's unlikely. Part of the reason I don't is I'm sort of terrified of the notion. I think I'm sort of worried about my genes. You know, I have this kind of wild and crazy chromosomes in there that I don't want to pass on to my kid. I wouldn't want to have a kid like me. So.
Well, I don't know if you mean that metaphorically, but, you know, there was just a study
that was
done saying that there's a certain kind of thrill-seeking adventurer that has a gene on chromosome 11 that is I think they're calling it a novelty-seeking trait that this gene is responsible for. So you think you, if tested, would be found to have this gene?
I would be surprised if I didn't, and other genes that are probably less healthy as well.
John, you're, what, 41 now?
Yeah.
Do high-risk activities still play a part in your life?
I'm afraid I have to admit that they do, although I leave a bigger margin for error. I still, every now and then, go do a serious – I still climb a lot, mostly reasonable climbs that befit a middle-aged man. But now and then, a couple of years ago, I climbed a really hard mountain in South America called Cerro Torre that was one time thought to be the hardest mountain in the world. It's not by the route I went up, but it was the hardest thing I'd ever done. It was much harder technically than the Devil's Thumb and much more dangerous, and I thought I was going to die a couple of times and wondered, what am I doing? I'm 41, you know, I'm married, I've got a wife I love. What the hell am I doing here? And went down after thinking that, and then, of course, a few days later when the weather got good, went back up again and climbed it. So I don't know. I mean, this is irrational stuff. This isn't – it doesn't make sense, this thrill-seeking. I mean, that's why I like writing about it. It's really complicated and really interesting. And, you know, you can't just explain it away. I think there's, you know, some people are just compelled to do this stuff. This gene we've been talking about might have something to do with it, or it might have just, you know, who knows? Who knows what? But it's there. And I think I'll be doing this stuff for a long time.
I realize this is probably none of our business, but do you think that maybe one of the reasons why you don't have kids is that it would be impossible to justify your taking physical risks if you had kids at home depending on you?
Yeah, I've thought about that. I have also thought, that's definitely crossed my mind. If you have a kid depending on you, you know, you need to be there for that kid. You can't afford to go off and kill yourself. It raises everything. I mean, it's not fair. It wouldn't be fair to my wife or my parents or my nieces if I died, but it'd be even worse for my kid. You know, I travel a lot just for my writing, and I feel like I'd feel bad about doing that if I had a kid. I'm sort of old-fashioned about child rearing, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I'm so ambivalent. I'd love to have kids, but I'm so terrified of kids. And I think, like my sisters who have kids, they just have none of that terror. It's just they just have this wonderful faith that everything's going to turn out all right. And I don't, you know, I'm sort of a pessimist, and that's mostly what keeps me from having kids. So I don't know, maybe I'll have kids. God, that would change everything.
So that's funny. They convince you everything would turn out all right with kids, but you're the one who has to convince them that everything's going to turn out when you go on, you know, a travel adventure. You couldn't be too much of a pessimist about that, or else you'd be staying home. I mean, if you really believed you'd die on each trip, you wouldn't be going.
No, I don't. I'm not that kind of pessimist. I, I, Although, you know, it used to be when I was young, I really would – I'd sort of get in this frame of mind that this climb is worth dying for. And that's very liberating. You think, it's worth dying for. I'm not going to worry about it anymore. I might die. And that's very liberating because it's sort of – you're not as afraid anymore. You've accepted the fact that you might die. I don't do that anymore. I mean, no climb is worth dying for. And I certainly don't enter into any climb thinking that. It's hard to – you know, I can't explain my weird pessimism. I have all these strange hoops I jump through to function in the world and telling myself I mean, telling myself that it's, you know, going to be terrible and everything's going to go poorly is sort of what I have to do before I can jump through that hoop. And, you know, I'm an odder person than I seem to my friends, I think. So now I'm confessing it.
I think I understand this particular oddness that you're mentioning.
Oh, you have that too?
A whole list of strange beliefs you have to have and peculiar rationalizations before going through with something that are utterly contradictory and people mock you for, but what can you do?
Right. Well, I'm glad someone understands.
do young people in their 20s ever ask you for advice before, you know, packing their backpack and setting off for the wilderness?
Oh, not often. The young guys, to them, I'm a dinosaur. I mean, mm-hmm. they're doing all these hard sport climbs, and I'm just this old fart, you know, who's in the climbing gym kind of struggling up climbs that they can do. Uh-huh. It's sort of fun. Like, I learned how to snowboard last year, and it's really fun. It's this young kid's sport, and it's you know, I skied my life, and I got sort of all my life, and I got bored with it, so I picked up snowboarding, which is this new challenge. And it's just fun. I mean, it's sort of – and the young kids look at me like, who the hell is that? You know, look at the weird clothes he's wearing. They have all this great baggy cotton stuff on, and I just look like – a 41-year-old geek. And it's sort of – I'm comfortable with that. I don't expect them to look up to me or like me or respect me. You know, I just – they're fun to be around, and it's fun to do stuff with them. And sometimes I'll go, hey, you know, not bad for an old man, and that – you feel pretty good. So – but, you know, no kids don't come to me looking for advice, which is probably all for the best.
Well, John Krakauer, thanks a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
John Krakauer is a contributing editor to Outside Magazine. His new book is called Into the Wild. This is Fresh Air. In a recent story, Billboard magazine said that Kirk Franklin is doing for gospel music what Garth Brooks has done for country music, expanding its audience to an unprecedented degree. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review of the album, Kirk Franklin and the Family.
I suspect that that powerful slice of gospel music called He's Able will sound to pop music listeners like prime 60s soul music orchestrated for a choir. This is exactly how Kirk Franklin, no relation it probably bears saying to Aretha Franklin, hopes you'll approach his material. He's still in his 20s, but Franklin has emerged as the most exciting performer in gospel because his understanding of the contemporary is matched by his grasp of history. He seems to have absorbed the great legacy of modern African-American gospel music, from Thomas Dorsey to Marion Williams to the Five Blind Boys of Alabama. At the same time, Franklin is a consummate modernist, self-conscious enough to even include a song about why he and his non-related family sing gospel. It's called Why We Sing.
I sing because I'm happy.
I sing because I'm happy.
I sing.
I sing because I'm free.
his eyes on
his eyes on the spare.
That's the reason.
That's the reason why I sing.
I want to know if you could help me say glory.
Glory, hallelujah.
You're the reason.
You're the reason why I sing.
Come on, say glory.
Glory, hallelujah.
Thank you, Jesus. You're the reason.
The reason why I sing.
Can we say it again? Someone asked.
Someone asked the question.
Oh, glory. Why do we sing?
Why do we sing?
When we lift our hands.
When we lift our hands to Jesus.
Oh, what do we really mean?
What do we really mean?
Someone may be wondering.
One of the things I like most about Franklin is the way he casts his religious exhortations in plain-spoken, contemporary terms, without ever seeming to be condescending or talking down to his audience. He directs the proceedings by speaking the phrase that the choir then sings. It amounts, in pop terms, to a kind of rapping followed by a soul response. Plus, he's not afraid to use a big, kicking rhythm section to get his message across. A humanist like me can really get behind a song as powerful as He Can Handle It. Further into that song, Franklin and the family break into a call-and-response bridge that develops into a funk rhythm that would make George Clinton's Parliament Funkadelic break into a cold sweat. Sure, one big reason I like Kirk Franklin's music is that it's as rooted in the secular as it is in the spiritual. Franklin may not convert me, but I find his message of all acceptance and redemptive love, when combined with a passionate understanding of how pop music can reach into the very depths of any listener with open ears and an open mind, very persuasive indeed.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the album Kirk Franklin and the Family on Gospocentric. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf, Barbara Bogave, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Alan Tu, who directed today's show. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Our intern is Phoebe Vanskoy. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harmony Books, publisher of Deepak Chopra's Ageless Body, Timeless Mind, and now 20 Lessons for Living a Magical Life in the Way of the Wizard. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Sean Penn. He stars in Dead Man Walking as a killer on death row facing his execution. It's his first performance in a couple of years after saying he was giving up acting to write and direct. Penn wrote and directed the film The Crossing Guard, starring Jack Nicholson and Angelica Houston. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.